While a howling throng of 3,000 or 4,000 surged about, men and women, young white girls from the country, rubbing elbows with big buck Negroes with daggers in their boots, while rows of woolly heads peered down from every window of the surrounding factories. The ancestors of these black people had been savages in Africa, and since then they had been chattel slaves, or had been held down by a community ruled by the traditions of slavery. Now, for the first time, they were free. Free to gratify every passion, free to wreck themselves. They were wanted to break a strike, and when it was broken, they would be shipped away, and their present masters would never see them again. And so whiskey and women were brought in by the carload and sold to them, and hell was let loose in the yards. Every night there were stabbings and shootings. It was said that the packers had blank permits, which enabled them to ship dead bodies from the city without troubling the authorities. They lodged men and women on the same floor, and with the night there began a saturnalia of debauchery, scenes such as never before had been witnessed in America. And as the women were the dregs from brothels of Chicago and the men, for the most part, ignorant country Negroes, the nameless diseases of vice were soon rife. And this, where food was being handled, which was sent out to every corner of the civilized world. The Union stockyards were never a pleasant place, but now they were not only a collection of slaughterhouses, but also the camping place of an army of 15,000 or 20,000 human beasts. All day long the blazing midsummer sun beat down upon that square mile of abominations, upon tens of thousands of cattle crowded into pens, whose wooden floors stank and steamed contagion, upon bare, blistering, cinder-strewn railroad tracks and huge blocks of dingy meat factories whose labyrinthine passages defied a breath of fresh air to penetrate them. And there were not merely rivers of hot blood and carloads of moist flesh and rendering vats and soap cauldrons, glue factories and fertilizer tanks that smelt like the craters of hell. There were also tons of garbage festering in the sun, and the greasy laundry of the workers hung out to dry, and dining rooms littered with food and black with flies, and toilet rooms that were open sewers. And then at night, when this throng poured out into the street to play, fighting, gambling, drinking, and carousing, cursing and screaming, laughing and singing, playing banjos and dancing. They were worked in the yards all the 7 days of the week, and they had their prize fights and crap games on Sunday nights as well. But then around the corner one might see a bonfire blazing, and an old gray-headed negress, lean and witch-like, her hair flying wild and her eyes blazing, yelling and chanting of the fires of perdition and the blood of the lamb, while men and women lay down upon the ground and moaned and screamed in convulsions of terror and remorse. Such were the stockyards during the strike, while the unions watched in sullen despair and the country clamored like a greedy child for its food, and the packers went grimly on their way. Each day they added new workers, and could be more stern with the old ones, could put them on piecework and dismiss them if they did not keep up the pace. Jurgis was now one of their agents in this process, and he could feel the change day by day. Like the slow starting up of a huge machine, he had gotten used to being a master of men, and because of the stifling heat and the stench and the fact that he was a scab and knew it and despised himself, he was drinking and developing a villainous temper, and he stormed and cursed and raged at his men and drove them until they were ready to drop with exhaustion. Then one day in late August, the superintendent ran into the place and shouted to Jurgis and his gang to drop their work and come. They followed him outside to where, in the midst of a dense throng, they saw several two-horse trucks waiting and 3 patrol wagon loads of police. Jurgis and his men sprang upon one of the trucks, and the driver yelled to the crowd, and they went thundering away at a gallop. Some steers had just escaped from the yards, and the strikers had got hold of them, and there would be the chance of a scrap. They went out at the Ashland Avenue gate and over in the direction of the dump. There was a yell as soon as they were sighted, men and women rushing out of houses and saloons as they galloped by. There were 8 or 10 policemen on the truck, however, and there was no disturbance until they came to a place where the street was blocked with a dense throng. Those on the flying truck yelled a warning, and the crowd scattered pell-mell, disclosing one of the steers lying in its blood. There were a good many cattle butchers about just then, with nothing much to do, and hungry children at home, and so someone had knocked out the steer, and as a first-class man can kill and dress one in a couple of minutes, there were a good many steaks and roasts already missing. This called for punishment, of course, and the police proceeded to administer it by leaping from the truck and cracking at every head they saw. There were yells of rage and pain, and the terrified people fled into houses and stores or scattered helter-skelter down the street. Jurgis and his gang joined in the sport, every man singling out his victim and striving to bring him to bay and punch him. If he fled into a house, his pursuer would smash in the flimsy door and follow him up the stairs, hitting everyone who came within reach, and finally dragging his squealing quarry from under a bed or a pile of old clothes in a closet. Jurgis and two policemen chased some men into a barroom. One of them took shelter behind the bar, where a policeman cornered him and proceeded to whack him over the back and shoulders until he lay down and gave a chance at his head. The others leaped a fence in the rear, balking the second policeman, who was fat, and as he came back, furious and cursing, a big Polish woman, the owner of the saloon, rushed in screaming and received a poke in the stomach that doubled her up on the floor. Meantime, Jurgis, who was of a practical temper, was helping himself at the bar, and the first policeman, who had laid out his man, joined him, handing out several more bottles and filling his pockets besides, and then, as he started to leave, cleaning off all the balance with a sweep of his club. The din of the glass crashing to the floor brought the fat Polish woman to her feet again, but another policeman came up behind her and put his knee into her back and his hands over her eyes, and then called to his companion, who went back and broke open the cash drawer and filled his pockets with the contents. Then the three went outside, and the man who was holding the woman gave her a shove and dashed out himself. The gang, having already got the carcass onto the truck, the party set out at a trot, followed by screams and curses and a shower of bricks and stones from unseen enemies. These bricks and stones would figure in the accounts of the riot, which would be sent out through a few thousand newspapers within an hour or two. But the episode of the cash drawer would never be mentioned again, save only in the heartbreaking legends of Packingtown. It was late in the afternoon when they got back, and they dressed out the remainder of the steer and a couple of others that had been killed, and then knocked off for the day. Jurgis went downtown to supper with three friends who had been on the other trucks, and they exchanged reminiscences on the way. Afterward, they drifted into a roulette parlor, and Jurgis, who was never lucky at gambling, dropped about $15. To console himself, he had to drink a good deal, and he went back to Packingtown about 2 o'clock in the morning, very much the worse for his excursion, and it must be confessed entirely deserving the calamity that was in store for him. As he was going to the place where he slept, he met a painted-cheeked woman in a greasy kimono, and she put her arm about his waist to steady him. They turned into a dark room they were passing, but scarcely had they taken two steps before suddenly a door swung open and a man entered carrying a lantern. "Who's there?" he called sharply, and Jurgis started to mutter some reply. But at the same instant the man raised his light, which flashed in his face so that it was possible to recognize him. Jurgis stood stricken dumb, and his heart gave a leap like a mad thing. The man was Connor. Connor, the boss of the loading gang, the man who had seduced his wife, who had sent him to prison and wrecked his home and ruined his life. He stood there, staring, with the light shining full upon him. Jurgis had often thought of Connor since coming back to Packingtown, but it had been as of something far off that no longer concerned him. Now, however, when he saw him, alive and in the flesh, the same thing happened to him that had happened before. A flood of rage boiled up in him. A blind frenzy seized him, and he flung himself at the man and smote him between the eyes, and then as he fell, seized him by the throat and began to pound his head upon the stones. The woman began screaming, and people came rushing in. The lantern had been upset and extinguished, and it was so dark they could not see a thing. But they could hear Jurgis panting and hear the thumping of his victim's skull, and they rushed there and tried to pull him off. Precisely as before, Jurgis came away with a piece of his enemy's flesh between his teeth, and as before, he went on fighting with those who had interfered with him until a policeman had come and beaten him into insensibility. And so Jurgis spent the balance of the night in the stockyard station house. This time, however, he had money in his pocket, and when he came to his senses, he could get something to drink, and also a messenger to take word of his plight to Bush Harper. Harper did not appear, however, until after the prisoner, feeling very weak and ill, had been hauled into court and remanded at $500 bail to await the result of his victim's injuries. Jurgis was wild about this because a different magistrate had chanced to be on the bench, and he had stated that he had never been arrested before, and also that he had been attacked first, and if only someone had been there to speak a good word for him, he could have been let off at once. But Harper explained that he had been downtown and had not got the message. "What happened to you?" he asked. "I've been doing a fellow up," said Jurgis, "and I've got to get $500 bail." "I can arrange that all right," said the other. "Though it may cost you a few dollars, of course, but what was the trouble?" "It was a man that did me a mean trick once," answered Jurgis. "Who is he?" "He's a foreman in Brown's, or used to be. His name's Connor." And the other gave a start. "Connor," he cried. "Not Phil Connor." "Yes," said Jurgis. "That's the fellow. Why?" "Good God," exclaimed the other. "Then you're in for it, old man. I can't help you." "Not help me? Why not?" "Why, he's one of Scully's biggest men, and he's a member of the War Whoop League, and they talked of sending him to the legislature." "Phil Connor, great heavens!" Jurgis sat dumb with dismay. "Why, he can send you to Joliet if he wants to," declared the other. "Can't I have Scully get me off before he finds out about it?" asked Jurgis at length. "But Scully's out of town," the other answered. "I don't even know where he is. He's run away to dodge the strike." That was a pretty mess indeed. Poor Jurgis sat half dazed. His pull had run up against a bigger pull, and he was down and out. "But what am I going to do?" he asked weakly. "How should I know?" said the other. "I shouldn't even dare to get bail for you. Why, I might ruin myself for life." Again there was silence. "Can't you do it for me?" Jurgis asked, "and pretend that you didn't know who I'd hit?" "But what good would that do you when you came to stand trial?" asked Harper. Then he sat buried in thought for a minute or two. "There's nothing, unless it's this," he said. "I could have your bail reduced, and then if you had the money, you could pay it and skip." "How much will it be?" Jurgis asked, after he'd had this explained more in detail. "I don't know," said the other. "How much do you own?" "I've got about $300, was the answer. "Well," was Harper's reply, "I'm not sure, but I'll try and get you off for that. I'll take the risk for friendship's sake, for I'd hate to see you sent to state's prison for a year or two." And so finally, Jurgis ripped out his bank book, which was sewed up in his trousers, and signed an order, which Bush Harper wrote, for all the money to be paid out. Then the latter went and got it and hurried to the court and explained to the magistrate that Jurgis was a decent fellow and a friend of Scully's who'd been attacked by a strikebreaker. So the bail was reduced to $300, and Harper went on it himself. He did not tell this to Jurgis, however. Nor did he tell him that when the time for trial came, it would be an easy matter for him to avoid forfeiting of the bail and pocket the $300 as his reward for the risk of offending Mike Scully. All that he told Jurgis was that he was now free, and that the best thing he could do was to clear out as quickly as possible. And so Jurgis, overwhelmed with gratitude and relief, took the $1.14 that was left him out of all his bank account and put it with the $2.25 that was left from his last night's celebration, and boarded a streetcar and got off at the other end of Chicago. Chapter 27 Poor Jurgis was now an outcast and a tramp once more. He was crippled. He was as literally crippled as any wild animal which has lost its claws or been torn out of its shell. He had been shorn at one cut of all those mysterious weapons whereby he had been able to make a living easily and to escape the consequences of his actions. He could no longer command a job when he wanted it. He could no longer steal with impunity. He must take his chances with the common herd. Nay, worse, he dared not mingle with the herd. He must hide by himself, for he was one marked out for destruction. His old companions would betray him for the sake of the influence they would gain thereby, and he would be made to suffer, not merely for the offense he had committed, but for others which would be laid at his door, just as had been done for some poor devil on the occasion of that assault upon the country customer by him and Duane. And also he labored under another handicap now. He had acquired new standards of living which were not easily to be altered. When he had been out of work before, he had been content if he could sleep in a doorway or under a truck out of the rain, and if he could get 15 cents a day for saloon lunches. But now he desired all sorts of other things, and suffered because he had to do without them. He must have a drink now and then, a drink for its own sake, and apart from the food that came with it. The craving for it was strong enough to master every other consideration. He would have it. though it were his last nickel, and he had to starve the balance of the day in consequence. Jurgis became once more a besieger of factory gates, but never since he had been in Chicago had he stood less chance of getting a job than just then. For one thing, there was the economic crisis. The million or two of men who had been out of work in the spring and summer and were not yet all back by any means. And then there was the strike, with 70,000 men and women all over the country idle for a couple of months, 20,000 in Chicago, and many of them now seeking work throughout the city. It did not remedy matters that a few days later the strike was given up, and about half the strikers went back to work. For every one taken on, there was a scab who gave up and fled. The 10,000 or 15,000 green Negroes, foreigners, and criminals were now being turned loose to shift for themselves. Everywhere Jurgis went, he kept meeting them, and he was in an agony of fear lest some one of them should know that he was wanted. He would have left Chicago, only by the time he had realized his danger, he was almost penniless, and it would be better to go to jail than to be caught out in the country in the wintertime. At the end of about 10 days, Jurgis had only a few pennies left, and he had not yet found a job, not even a day's work at anything, not a chance to carry a satchel. Once again, as when he had come out of the hospital, he was bound hand and foot, and facing the grisly phantom of starvation. Raw, naked terror possessed him, a maddening passion that would never leave him, and that wore him down more quickly than the actual want of food. He was going to die of hunger. The fiend reached out its scaly arms for him. It touched him. Its breath came into his face, and he would cry out for the awfulness of it. He would wake up in the night shuddering and bathed in perspiration and start up and flee. He would walk begging for work until he was exhausted. He could not remain still. He would wander on, gaunt and haggard, gazing about him with restless eyes. Everywhere he went, from one end of the vast city to the other, there were hundreds of others like him. Everywhere was the sight of plenty, and the merciless hand of authority waving them away. There is one kind of prison where the man is behind bars, and everything that he desires is outside, and there is another kind where the things are behind the bars, and the man is outside. When he was down to his last quarter, Jurgis learned that before the bake shops closed at night, they sold out what was left at half price, and after that he would go and get 2 loaves of stale bread for a nickel, and break them up and stuff his pockets with them, munching a bit from time to time. He would not spend a penny save for this, and after 2 or 3 days more, he even became sparing of the bread, and would stop and peer into the ash barrels as he walked along the streets, and now and then rake out a bit of something, shake it free from dust, and count himself just so many minutes further from the end. So, for several days, he had been going about, ravenous all the time, and growing weaker and weaker, and then one morning he had a hideous experience that almost broke his heart. He was passing down a street lined with warehouses, and a boss offered him a job, and then, after he had started to work, turned him off because he was not strong enough. And he stood by and saw another man put into his place, and then picked up his coat and walked off, doing all that he could to keep from breaking down and crying like a baby. He was lost. He was doomed. There was no hope for him. But then, with a sudden rush, his fear gave place to rage. He fell to cursing. He would come back there after dark, and he would show that scoundrel whether he was good for anything or not. He was still muttering this when suddenly, at the corner, he came upon a green grocery with a tray full of cabbages in front of it. Jurgis, after one swift glance about him, stooped and seized the biggest of them and darted round the corner with it. There was a hue and cry, and a score of men and boys started to chase him. But he came to an alley and then to another, branching off from it and leading him into another street, where he fell into a walk and slipped his cabbage under his coat and went off unsuspected in the crowd. When he had gotten a safe distance away, he sat down and devoured half the cabbage raw, stowing the balance away in his pockets till the next day. Just about this time, one of the Chicago newspapers, which made much of the common people, opened a free soup kitchen for the benefit of the unemployed. Some people said that they did this for the sake of the advertising it gave them, and some others said that their motive was a fear lest all their readers should be starved off. But whatever the reason, the soup was thick and hot, and there was a bowl for every man all night long. When Jurgis heard of this from a fellow hobo, he vowed that he would have 6 bowls before morning. But as it proved, he was lucky to get one, for there was a line of men 2 blocks long before the stand, and there was just as long a line when the place was finally closed up. This depot is within the danger line for Jurgis, in the levee district, where he was known, but he went there all the same, for he was desperate and beginning to think of even the Bridewell as a place of refuge. So far the weather had been fair, and he had slept out every night in a vacant lot, but now there fell suddenly a shadow of the advancing winter, a chill wind from the north, and a driving storm of rain. That day Jurgis bought 2 drinks for the sake of the shelter, and at night he spent his last 2 pennies in a stale beer dive. This was a place kept by a negro who went out and drew off the old dregs of beer that lay in barrels set outside of the saloons, and after he had doctored it with chemicals to make it fizz, he sold it for 2 cents a can, the purchase of a can including the privilege of sleeping the night through upon the floor with a mass of degraded outcasts, men and women. All these horrors afflicted Jurgis all the more cruelly because he was always contrasting them with the opportunities he had lost. For instance, just now, it was election time again, and within 5 or 6 weeks the voters of the country would select a president, and he heard the wretches with whom he associated discussing it, and saw the streets of the city decorated with placards and banners. And what words could describe the pangs of grief and despair that shot through him? For instance, there was a night during this cold spell. He had begged all day for his very life, and found not a soul to heed him, until toward evening he saw an old lady getting off a streetcar and helped her down with her umbrellas and bundles, and then told her his hard luck story, and after answering all her suspicious questions satisfactorily, was taken to a restaurant and saw a quarter paid down for a meal. And so he had soup and bread and boiled beef and potatoes and beans and pie and coffee, and came out with his skin stuffed tight as a football. And then, through the rain and the darkness far down the street, he saw red lights flaring, and heard the thumping of a bass drum, and his heart gave a leap, and he made for the place on the run, knowing without the asking that it meant a political meeting. The campaign had so far been characterized by what the newspapers termed apathy. For some reason, the people refused to get excited over the struggle, and it was almost impossible to get them to come to meetings or to make any noise when they did come. Those which had been held in Chicago so far had proven most dismal failures, and tonight, the speaker being no less a personage than a candidate for the vice presidency of the nation, the political managers had been trembling with anxiety. But a merciful providence had sent this storm of cold rain, and now all it was necessary to do was to set off a few fireworks and thump a while on a drum, and all the homeless wretches from a mile around would pour in and fill the hall. And then, on the morrow, the newspapers would have a chance to report the tremendous ovation and to add that it had been no silk-stocking audience either, proving clearly that the high tariff sentiments of the distinguished candidate were pleasing to the wage earners of the nation. So Jurgis found himself in a large hall, elaborately decorated with flags and bunting, and after the chairman had made his little speech and the orator of the evening rose up amid an uproar from the band, only fancy the emotions of Jurgis upon making the discovery that the personage was none other than the famous and eloquent Senator Spareshanks, who had addressed the Doyle Republican Association at the stockyards and helped to elect Mike Scully's 10-pin setter to the Chicago Board of Aldermen. In truth, the sight of the senator almost brought tears into Jurgis's eyes. What agony it was to him to look back upon those golden hours when he, too, had a place beneath the shadow of the plum tree, when he, too, had been of the elect through whom the country is governed, when he had had a bung in the campaign barrel for his own, and this was another election in which the Republicans had all the money. And but for that one hideous accident, he might have had a share of it, instead of being where he was. The eloquent senator was explaining the system of protection, an ingenious device whereby the working man permitted the manufacturer to charge him higher prices in order that he might receive higher wages, thus taking his money out of his pocket with one hand and putting a part of it back with the other. To the senator, this unique arrangement had somehow become identified with the higher verities of the universe. It was because of it that Columbia was the gem of the ocean, and all her future triumphs, her power and good repute among the nations, depended upon the zeal and fidelity with which each citizen held up the hands of those who were toiling to maintain it. The name of this heroic company was the Grand Old Party. And here the band began to play, and Jurgis sat up with a violent start. Singular as it may seem, Jurgis was making a desperate effort to understand what the senator was saying, to comprehend the extent of American prosperity, the enormous expansion of American commerce, and the Republic's future in the Pacific and in South America, and wherever else the oppressed were groaning. The reason for it was that he wanted to keep awake. He knew that if he allowed himself to fall asleep, he would begin to snore loudly, and so he must listen. He must be interested. But he had eaten such a big dinner, and he was so exhausted, and the hall was so warm, and his seat was so comfortable. The senator's gaunt form began to grow dim and hazy, to tower before him and dance about with figures of exports and imports. Once his neighbor gave him a savage poke in the ribs, and he sat up with a start and tried to look innocent. But then he was at it again, and men began to stare at him with annoyance and to call out in vexation. Finally, one of them called a policeman who came and grabbed Jurgis by the collar and jerked him to his feet, bewildered and terrified. Some of the audience turned to see the commotion, and Senator Spareshanks faltered in his speech. But a voice shouted cheerily, "We're just firing a bomb! Go ahead, old sport!" And the crowd roared, and the senator smiled genially and went on. And in a few seconds, Porter Jurgis found himself landed out in the rain with a kick and a string of curses. He got into the shelter of a doorway and took stock of himself. He was not hurt, and he was not arrested, more than he had any right to expect. He swore at himself and his luck for a while, and then turned his thoughts to practical matters. He had no money and no place to sleep. He must begin begging again. He went out, hunching his shoulders together and shivering at the touch of the icy rain. Coming down the street toward him was a lady, well-dressed and protected by an umbrella, and he turned and walked beside her. "Please, ma'am," he began, "could you lend me the price of a night's lodging? I'm a poor working man." Then suddenly he stopped short. By the light of a street lamp he had caught sight of the lady's face. He knew her. It was Elena Yasaitieta, who had been the belle of his wedding feast. Elena Yasaitieta, who had looked so beautiful and danced with such a queenly air with Yosius Rasius, the teamster. Jurgis had only seen her once or twice afterward, for Yosius had thrown her over for another girl, and Elena had gone away from Packingtown. No one knew where. And now he met her here. She was as much surprised as he was. "Jurgis Rutkis," she gasped. "And what in the world is the matter with you?"
I've had hard luck," he stammered. "I'm out of work, and I've no home and no money. And you, Elena, are you married?"
"No," she answered. "I'm not married, but I've got a good place." They stood staring at each other for a few moments longer. Finally, Elena spoke again.
"Jurgis," she said, "I'd help you if I could. Upon my word, I would. But it happens that I've come out without my purse, and I honestly haven't a penny with me. I can do something better for you, though. I can tell you how to get help. I can tell you where Maria is."
Jurgis gave a start. "Maria?" he gasped.
"Yes," said Elena, "and she'll help you. She's got a place, and she's doing well. She'll be glad to see you."
It was not much more than a year since Jurgis had left Packingtown, feeling like one escaped from jail, and it had been from Maria and Elzbieta that he was escaping. But now, at the mere mention of them, his whole being cried out with joy. He wanted to see them. He wanted to go home. They would help him. They would be kind to him. In a flash, he had thought over the situation. He had a good excuse for running away, his grief at the death of his son, and also he had a good excuse for not returning, the fact that they had left Packingtown.
"All right," he said, "I'll go."
So she gave him a number on Clark Street, adding, "There's no need to give you my address, because Maria knows it." And Jurgis set out without further ado. He found a large brownstone house of aristocratic appearance and rang the basement bell. A young colored girl came to the door, opening it about an inch and gazing at him suspiciously. "What do you want?" she demanded.
"Does Maria Bershinskas live here?" he inquired.
"I don't know," said the girl. "What you want with her?"
"I want to see her," said he. "She is a relative of mine."
The girl hesitated a moment, then she opened the door and said, "Come in." Jurgis came and stood in the hall, and she continued, "I'll go see. What's your name?"
"Tell her it's Jurgis," he answered, and the girl went upstairs. She came back at the end of a minute or two and replied, "Dey ain't no sich person here." Jurgis's heart went down into his boots. "I was told this was where she lived," he cried, but the girl only shook her head. "The lady says dey ain't no sich person here," she said, and he stood for a moment hesitating, helpless with dismay. Then he turned to go to the door. At the same instant, however, there came a knock upon it, and the girl went to open it. Jurgis heard the shuffling of her feet, and then heard her give a cry, and the next moment she sprang back and past him, her eyes shining white with terror, and bounded up the stairway, screaming at the top of her lungs, "Police! Police! We're pinched!" Jurgis stood for a second bewildered, then seeing blue-coated forms rushing upon him, he sprang after the negress. Her cries had been the signal for a wild uproar above. The house was full of people, and as she entered the hallway, he saw them rushing hither and thither, crying and screaming with alarm. There were men and women, the latter clad for the most part in wrappers, the former in all stages of déshabillé. At one side, Jurgis caught a glimpse of a big apartment with plush-covered chairs and tables covered with trays and glasses. There were playing cards scattered all over the floor. One of the tables had been upset, and bottles of wine were rolling about, their contents running out upon the carpet. There was a young girl who had fainted and two men who were supporting her, and there were a dozen others crowding toward the front door. Suddenly, however, there came a series of resounding blows upon it, causing the crowd to give back. At the same instant, a stout woman with painted cheeks and diamonds in her ears came running down the stairs, panting breathlessly. "To the rear, quick!" She led the way to a back staircase, Jurgis following. In the kitchen she pressed a spring, and a cupboard gave way and opened, disclosing a dark passageway. "Go in," she cried to the crowd, which now amounted to 20 or 30, and they began to pass through. Scarcely had the last one disappeared, however, before there were cries from in front, and then the panic-stricken throng poured out again, exclaiming, "They're there, too! We're trapped!" "Upstairs!" cried the woman, and there was another rush of the mob, women and men cursing and screaming and fighting to be first. One flight, two, three, and then there was a ladder to the roof, with a crowd packed at the foot of it, and one man at the top, straining and struggling to lift the trapdoor. It was not to be stirred, however, and when the woman shouted up to unhook it, he answered, "It's already unhooked! There's somebody sitting on it!" And a moment later came a voice from downstairs, "You might as well quit, you people. We mean business this time." So the crowd subsided, and a few moments later, several policemen came up, staring here and there and leering at their victims. Of the latter, the men were for the most part frightened and sheepish-looking. The women took it as a joke, as if they were used to it, though if they had been pale, one could not have told for the paint on their cheeks. One black-eyed young girl perched herself upon the top of the balustrade and began to kick with her slippered foot at the helmets of the policemen, until one of them caught her by the ankle and pulled her down. On the floor below, four or five girls sat upon trunks in the hall making fun of the procession which filed by them. They were noisy and hilarious and had evidently been drinking. One of them, who wore a bright red kimono, shouted and screamed in a voice that drowned out all the other sounds in the hall, and Jurgis took a glance at her, and then gave a start and a cry. "Maria!" She heard him and glanced around, then shrank back and half sprang to her feet in amazement. "Jurgis!" she gasped. For a second or two they stood staring at each other. "How did you come here?" Maria exclaimed.
"I came to see you," he answered.
"When?"
"Just now."
"But how did you know? Who told you I was here?"
"Elena Yesaitieta. I met her on the street."
Again there was a silence while they gazed at each other. The rest of the crowd was watching them, and so Maria got up and came closer to him.
"And you?" Jurgis asked. "You live here?"
"Yes," said Maria, "I live here."
Then suddenly came a hail from below. "Get your clothes on now, girls, and come along. You'd best begin, or you'll be sorry. It's raining outside."
"Brrr!" shivered someone, and the women got up and entered various doors which lined the hallway.
"Come," said Maria, and took Jurgis into her room, which was a tiny place about 8x6 with a cot and a chair and a dressing stand, and some dresses hanging behind the door. There were clothes scattered about on the floor, and hopeless confusion everywhere. Boxes of rouge and bottles of perfume mixed with hats and soiled dishes on the dresser, and a pair of slippers and a clock and a whiskey bottle on a chair. Maria had nothing on but a kimono and a pair of stockings, yet she proceeded to dress before Jurgis, and without even taking the trouble to close the door. He had by this time divined what sort of a place he was in, and he had seen a great deal of the world since he had left home, and was not easy to shock, and yet it gave him a painful start that Maria should do this. They had always been decent people at home, and it seemed to him that the memory of old times ought to have ruled her. But then he laughed at himself for a fool. What was he to be pretending to decency?
"How long have you been living here?" he asked.
"Nearly a year," she answered.
"Why did you come?"
"I had to live," she said, "and I couldn't see the children starve."
He paused for a moment, watching her. "You are out of work?"
he asked finally. "I got sick," she replied, "and after that I had no money. And then Stanislavas died."
"Stanislavas dead?"
"Yes," said Maria. "I forgot. You didn't know about it."
"How did he die?"
"Rats killed him," she answered. Jurgis gave a gasp.
"Rats killed him?"
"Yes," said the other. She was bending over, lacing her shoes as she spoke. "He was working in an oil factory. At least, he was hired by the men to get their beer. He used to carry cans on a long pole, and he'd drink a little out of each can. And one day he drank too much and fell asleep in a corner, and got locked up in the place all night. When they found him, the rats had killed him and eaten him nearly all up." Jurgis sat frozen with horror. Maria went on lacing up her shoes. There was a long silence. Suddenly a big policeman came to the door.
"Hurry up there," he said.
"As quick as I can," said Maria, and she stood up and began putting on her corsets with feverish haste.
"Are the rest of the people alive?" asked Jurgis finally.
"Yes," she said.
"Where are they?"
"They live not far from here. They're all right now."
"They're working?" he inquired.
"Elzbieta is," said Maria, "when she can. I take care of them most of the time. I'm making plenty of money now."
Jurgis was silent for a moment. "Do they know you live here? How you live?" he asked.
"Elzbieta knows," answered Maria. "I couldn't lie to her.
And maybe the children have found out by this time. It's nothing to be ashamed of. We can't help it."
"And Timosius?" he asked. "Does he know?"
Maria shrugged her shoulders.
"How do I know?" she said. "I haven't seen him for over a year. He got blood poisoning and lost one finger and couldn't play the violin anymore, and then he went away."
Maria was standing in front of the glass, fastening her dress. Jurgis sat staring at her. He could hardly believe that she was the same woman he had known in the old days. She was so quiet, so hard. It struck fear to his heart to watch her. Then suddenly she gave a glance at him.
"You look as if you've been having a rough time of it yourself," she said.
"I have," he answered. "I haven't a cent in my pockets and nothing to do."
"Where have you been?"
"All over. I've been hoboing it. Then I went back to the yards just before the strike." He paused for a moment, hesitating. "I asked for you," he added. "I found you had gone away. No one knew where. Perhaps you think I did you a dirty trick running away as I did, Maria."
"No,"
she answered. "I don't blame you. We never have, any of us. You did your best. The job was too much for us." She paused a moment, then added, "We were too ignorant. That was the trouble. We didn't stand any chance. If I'd known what I know now, we'd have won out."
"You'd have come here?" said Jurgis.
"Yes," she answered. "But that's not what I meant. I meant you, how differently you would have behaved. About Ona."
Jurgis was silent. He had never thought of that aspect of it.
"When people are starving," the other continued, "and they have anything with a price, they ought to sell it, I say. I guess you realize it now when it's too late. Ona could have taken care of us all in the beginning."
Maria spoke without emotion, as one who had come to regard things from the business point of view.
Yes, I guess so,
Jurgis answered hesitatingly. He did not add that he had paid $300 in a foreman's job for the satisfaction of knocking down Phil Connor a second time. The policeman came to the door again just then.
"Come on now," he said. "Lively!"
"All right," said Maria, reaching for her hat, which was big enough to be a drum major's and full of ostrich feathers. She went out into the hall, and Jurgis followed, the policeman remaining to look under the bed and behind the door.
"What's going to come of this?" Jurgis asked as they started down the steps.
The raid, you mean? Oh, nothing. It happens to us every now and then. The madam's having some sort of time with the police. I don't know what it is, but maybe they'll come to terms before morning. Anyhow, they won't do anything to you. They always let the men off.
Maybe so, he responded, but not me. I'm afraid I'm in for it.
How do you mean?
I'm wanted by the police, he said, lowering his voice, though of course their conversation was in Lithuanian.
They'll send me up for a year or two, I'm afraid.
Hell, said Maria. That's too bad. I'll see if I can't get you off.
Downstairs, where the greater part of the prisoners were now massed, she sought out the stout personage with the diamond earrings and had a few whispered words with her. The latter then approached the police sergeant who was in charge of the raid.
Billy, she said, pointing to Jurgis, there's a fellow who came in to see his sister. He's just got in the door when you knocked. You aren't taking hobos, are you?
The sergeant laughed as he looked at Jurgis.
Sorry, he said, but the orders are everyone but the servants.
So Jurgis slunk in among the rest of the men, who kept dodging behind each other like sheep that have smelt a wolf. There were old men and young men, college boys and graybeards old enough to be their grandfathers. Some of them wore evening dress. There was no one among them save Jurgis who showed any signs of poverty. When the roundup was completed, the doors were opened and the party marched out. Three patrol wagons were drawn up at the curb, and the whole neighborhood had turned out to see the sport. There was much chaffing and a universal craning of necks. The women stared about them with defiant eyes or laughed and joked while the men kept their heads bowed and their hats pulled over their faces. They were crowded into the patrol wagons as if into streetcars, and then off they went amid a din of cheers. At the station house, Jurgis gave a Polish name and was put into a cell with half a dozen others, and while these sat and talked in whispers, he lay down in a corner and gave himself up to his thoughts. Jurgis had looked into the deepest reaches of the social pit and had grown used to the sights in them. Yet when he had thought of all humanity as vile and hideous, he had somehow always accepted his own family, that he had loved, and now this sudden horrible discovery. Maria, a whore, and Elzbieta and the children living off her shame. Jurgis might argue with himself all he chose, that he had done worse and was a fool for caring. But still, he could not get over the shock of that sudden unveiling. He could not help being sunk in grief because of it. The depths of him were troubled and shaken. Memories were stirred in him that had been sleeping so long he had counted them dead. Memories of the old life, his old hopes and his old yearnings, his old dreams of decency and independence. He saw Ona again. He heard her gentle voice pleading with him. He saw little Antanas, whom he had meant to make a man. He saw his trembling old father, who had blessed them all with his wonderful love. He lived again through the day of horror when he had discovered Ona's shame. God, how he had suffered! What a madman he had been! How dreadful it had all seemed to him! And now today, he had sat and listened and half agreed when Maria told him he had been a fool. Yes, told him that he ought to have sold his wife's honor and lived by it. And then there was Stanislavas and his awful fate, that brief story which Maria had narrated so calmly, with such dull indifference. The poor little fellow with his frostbitten fingers and his terror of the snow. His wailing voice ran in Jurgis's ears as he lay there in the darkness until the sweat started on his forehead. Now and then he would quiver with a sudden spasm of horror at the picture of little Stanislavas, shut up in the deserted building and fighting for his life with the rats. All these emotions had become strangers to the soul of Jurgis. It was so long since they had troubled him that he had ceased to think they might ever trouble him again. Helpless, trapped as he was, what good did they do him? Why should he ever have allowed them to torment him? It had been the task of his recent life to fight them down, to crush them out of him. Never in his life would he have suffered from them again, save that they had caught him unawares and overwhelmed him before he could protect himself. He heard the old voices of his soul. He saw its old ghosts beckoning to him, stretching out their arms to him. But they were far off and shadowy, and the gulf between them was black and bottomless. They would fade away into the mists of the past once more. Their voices would die, and never again would he hear them. And so the last faint spark of manhood in his soul would flicker out.
Chapter 28. After breakfast, Jurgis was driven to the court, which was crowded with the prisoners and those who had come out of curiosity or in the hope of recognizing one of the men and getting a case for blackmail. The men were called up first and reprimanded in a bunch and then dismissed, but Jurgis, to his terror, was called separately as being a suspicious-looking case. It was in this very same court that he had been tried, that time when his sentence had been suspended. It was the same judge and the same clerk. The latter now stared at Jurgis as if he half thought that he knew him. But the judge had no suspicions. Just then his thoughts were upon a telephone message he was expecting from a friend of the police captain of the district, telling what disposition he should make of the case of Polly Simpson, as the madam of the house was known. Meantime, he listened to the story of how Jurgis had been looking for his sister, and advised him dryly to keep his sister in a better place. Then he let him go and proceeded to fine each of the girls $5, which fines were paid in a bunch from a wad of bills which Madam Polly extracted from her stocking. Jurgis waited outside and walked home with Maria. The police had left the house, and already there were a few visitors. By evening, the place would be running again, exactly as if nothing had happened. Meantime, Maria took Jurgis upstairs to her room, and they sat and talked. By daylight, Jurgis was able to observe that the color on her cheeks was not the old natural one of abounding health. Her complexion was, in reality, a parchment yellow, and there were black rings under her eyes. "Have you been sick?" he asked. "Sick?" she said. "Hell!" Maria had learned to scatter her conversation with as many oaths as a longshoreman or a mule driver. "How can I ever be anything but sick at this life?" She fell silent for a moment, staring ahead of her gloomily. "It's morphine," she said at last. "I seem to need more of it every day." "What's that for?" he asked. "It's the way of it. I don't know why. If it isn't that, it's drink. If the girls didn't booze, they couldn't stand it any time at all. And the madam always gives them dope when they first come, and they learn to like it, or else they take it for headaches and such things, and get the habit that way. I've got it, I know. I've tried to quit, but I never will while I'm here." "How long are you going to stay?" he asked. "I don't know," she said. "Always, I guess. What else could I do?" "Don't you save any money?" "Save?" said Maria. "Good Lord, no. I get enough, I suppose, but it all goes. I get a half share, $2.50 for each customer, and sometimes I make $25 or $30 a night, and you'd think I ought to save something out of that. But then I am charged for my room and my meals, in such prices as you never heard of, and then for extras and drinks, for everything I get, and some I don't. My laundry bill is nearly $20 each week alone, think of that. Yet what can I do? I either have to stand it or quit, and it would be the same anywhere else. It's all I can do to save the $15 I give Elzbieta each week so the children can go to school." Maria sat brooding in silence for a while. Then, seeing that Jurgis was interested, she went on. "That's the way they keep the girls. They let them run up debts so they can't get away. A young girl comes from abroad, and she doesn't know a word of English, and she gets into a place like this, and when she wants to go, the madam shows her that she is a couple of $100 in debt, and takes all her clothes away, and threatens to have her arrested if she doesn't stay and do as she's told. So she stays. And the longer she stays, the more in debt she gets. Often, too, they are girls that didn't know what they were coming to, that had hired out for housework. Did you notice that little French girl with the yellow hair that stood next to me in the court?" Jurgis answered in the affirmative. "Well, she came to America about a year ago. She was a store clerk, and she hired herself to a man to be sent here to work in a factory. There were six of them, all together, and they were brought to a house just down the street from here, and this girl was put into a room alone, and they gave her some dope and her food, and when she came to, she found that she had been ruined. She cried and screamed and tore her hair, but she had nothing but a wrapper and couldn't get away, and they kept her half insensible with drugs all the time until she gave up. She never got outside of that place for 10 months, and then they sent her away because she didn't suit. I guess they'll put her out of here, too. She's getting to have crazy fits from drinking absinthe.
Only one of the girls that came out with her got away, and she jumped out of a second-story window one night. There was a great fuss about that. Maybe you heard of it.
I did, said Jurgis. I heard of it afterward.
It had happened in the place where he and Duane had taken refuge from their country customer. The girl had become insane, fortunately for the police.
There's lots of money in it, said Maria.
They get as much as $40 a head for girls, and they bring them from all over. There are 17 in this place, and 9 different countries among them. In some places you might find even more. We have 6 French girls. I suppose it's because the madam speaks the language. French girls are bad, too, the worst of all, except for the Japanese. There's a place next door that's full of Japanese women, but I wouldn't live in the same house with one of them.
Maria paused for a moment or two, and then she added, "Most of the women here are pretty decent. You'd be surprised. I used to think they did it because they liked to, but fancy a woman selling herself to every kind of man that comes, old or young, black or white, and doing it because she likes to."
"Some of them say they do," said Jurgis.
"I know," she said. "They say anything. They're in, and they know they can't get out. But they didn't like it when they began, you'd find out. It's always misery. There's a little Jewish girl here who used to run errands for a milliner, and got sick and lost her place, and she was 4 days on the street without a mouthful of food. And then she went to a place just around the corner and offered herself, and they made her give up her clothes before they would give her a bit to eat."
Maria sat for a minute or two, brooding somberly.
"Tell me about yourself, Jurgis," she said suddenly. "Where have you been?"
So he told her the long story of his adventures since his flight from home, his life as a tramp and his work in the freight tunnels, and the accident, and then of Jack Duane, and of his political career in the stockyards, and his downfall and subsequent failures. Maria listened with sympathy. It was easy to believe the tale of his late starvation, for his face showed it all.
"You found me just in the nick of time," she said. "I'll stand by you. I'll help you till you can get some work."
"I don't like to let you," he began.
"Why not? Because I'm here?"
"No, not that," he said. "But I went off and left you."
"Nonsense," said Maria. "Don't think about it. I don't blame you."
"You must be hungry," she said after a minute or two. "You stay here to lunch. I'll have something up in the room." She pressed a button, and a colored woman came to the door and took her order. "It's nice to have somebody to wait on you," she observed with a laugh as she lay back on the bed. As the prison breakfast had not been liberal, Jurgis had a good appetite, and they had a little feast together, talking meanwhile of Elzbieta and the children and old times. Shortly before they were through, there came another colored girl with the message that the madam wanted Maria. Lithuanian Mary, as they called her here.
"That means you have to go," she said to Jurgis.
So he got up and she gave him the new address of the family, a tenement over in the ghetto district. "You go there," she said. "They'll be glad to see you." But Jurgis stood hesitating.
I don't like to," he said. "Honest, Maria, why don't you give me a little money and let me look for work first?"
"How do you need money?" was her reply. "All you want is something to eat and a place to sleep, isn't it?"
"Yes," he said. "But then I don't like to go there after I left them, and while I have nothing to do, and while you...
"Go on," said Maria, giving him a push. "What are you talking? I won't give you money," she added as she followed him to the door, "because you'll drink it up and do yourself harm. Here's a quarter for you now, and go along, and they'll be so glad to have you back, you won't have time to feel ashamed. Goodbye!"
So Jurgis went out and walked down the street to think it over. He decided that he would first try to get work, and so he put in the rest of the day wandering here and there among factories and warehouses without success. Then, when it was nearly dark, he concluded to go home and set out. But he came to a restaurant and went in and spent his quarter for a meal, and when he came out he changed his mind. The night was pleasant, and he would sleep somewhere outside and put in the morrow hunting, and so have one more chance of a job. So he started away again, when suddenly he chanced to look about him and found that he was walking down the same street and past the same hall where he had listened to the political speech the night before.
There was no red fire and no band now, but there was a sign out announcing a meeting, and a stream of people pouring in through the entrance. In a flash, Jurgis had decided that he would chance it once more and sit down and rest while making up his mind what to do. There was no one taking tickets, so it must be a free show again. He entered. There were no decorations in the hall this time, but there was quite a crowd upon the platform, and almost every seat in the place was filled. He took one of the last, far in the rear, and straightway forgot all about his surroundings. Would Elsbieta think that he had come to sponge off her, or would she understand that he meant to get to work again and do his share? Would she be decent to him, or would she scold him? If only he could get some sort of a job before he went. If that last boss had only been willing to try him. Then suddenly Jurgis looked up. A tremendous roar had burst from the throats of the crowd, which by this time had packed the hall to the very doors. Men and women were standing up, waving handkerchiefs, shouting, yelling. Evidently the speaker had arrived, thought Jurgis. What fools they were making of themselves. What were they expecting to get out of it anyhow? What had they to do with elections, with governing the country? Jurgis had been behind the scenes in politics. He went back to his thoughts, but with one further fact to reckon with. That he was caught here. The hall was now filled to the doors, and after the meeting, it would be too late for him to go home, so he would have to make the best of it outside. Perhaps it would be better to go home in the morning, anyway, for the children would be at school, and he and Elsbieta could have a quiet explanation. She always had been a reasonable person, and he really did mean to do right. He would manage to persuade her of it, and besides, Maria was willing, and Maria was furnishing the money. If Elsbieta were ugly, he would tell her that in so many words. So Jurgis went on meditating, until finally, when he had been an hour or two in the hall, there began to prepare itself a repetition of the dismal catastrophe of the night before. Speaking had been going on all the time, and the audience was clapping its hands and shouting, thrilling with excitement. And little by little the sounds were beginning to blur in Jurgis's ears, and his thoughts were beginning to run together, and his head to wobble and nod. He caught himself many times as usual and made desperate resolutions, but the hall was hot and close, and his long walk and his dinner were too much for him. In the end his head sank forward, and he went off again. And then again someone nudged him, and he sat up with his old terrified start. He'd been snoring again, of course. And now what? He fixed his eyes ahead of him with painful intensity, staring at the platform as if nothing else ever had interested him, or ever could interest him all his life. He imagined the angry exclamations, the hostile glances. He imagined the policeman striding towards him, reaching for his neck. Or was he to have one more chance? Were they going to let him alone this time? He sat trembling, waiting, and then suddenly came a voice in his ear, a woman's voice, gentle and sweet. "If you would try to listen, comrade, perhaps you would be interested." Jurgis was more startled by that than he would have been by the touch of a policeman. He still kept his eyes fixed ahead and did not stir, but his heart gave a great leap. Comrade! Who was it that called him comrade? He waited long, long. And at last, when he was sure that he was no longer watched, he stole a glance out of the corner of his eyes at the woman who sat beside him. She was young and beautiful. She wore fine clothes, and was what is called a lady. And she called him comrade. He turned a little, carefully, so that he could see her better. Then he began to watch her, fascinated. She had apparently forgotten all about him, and was looking towards the platform. A man was speaking there. Jurgis heard his voice vaguely, but all his thoughts were for this woman's face. A feeling of alarm stole over him as he stared at her. It made his flesh creep. What was the matter with her? What could be going on to affect anyone like that? She sat as one turned to stone, her hands clenched tightly in her lap, so tightly that he could see the cords standing out in her wrists. There was a look of excitement upon her face, of tense effort, as of one struggling mightily or witnessing a struggle. There was a faint quivering of her nostrils, and now and then she would moisten her lips with feverish haste. Her bosom rose and fell as she breathed, and her excitement seemed to mount higher and higher, and then to sink away again, like a boat tossing upon ocean surges. What was it? What was the matter?
It must be something that the man was saying, up there on the platform. What sort of a man was he? And what sort of a thing was this, anyhow? So all at once it occurred to Jurgis to look at the speaker. It was like coming suddenly upon some wild sight of nature, a mountain forest lashed by a tempest, a ship tossed upon a stormy sea. Jurgis had an unpleasant sensation, a sense of confusion, of disorder, of wild and meaningless uproar.